Hey guys, my name is Miller Montgomery and welcome to the King Collective podcast, where I interview men making a massive difference in the world. These are kings of their kingdom. Listen in.
Hey guys, it's Miller here and welcome to another episode. And today, I just want to say I'm very, very, very excited to be sitting across the table here from this man. He has been a very much of an inspiration to myself and millions of other people, I'm sure, around Australia for the value that he brings and the experience that he shares with his audience. So, yeah, I'm giddy. If I want to say it, I'm giddy. I feel like a kid in the candy store.
Oh, mate, it's great to be here. Thank you, Miller. I really appreciate you being the opportunity to be on here, mate, and yeah, have this kind of a chat.
No worries, brother. Kieran Ray, you're a single dad.
Yes.
You're a high performance specialist.
Yes.
You're just an all around good bloke.
And thanks, man.
So the first thing I wanted to ask, mate, is, you know, your parents split when you were under one.
Yep. 6 months.
So yeah, like what, I guess, effects do you feel like that had on you, good or bad, if any, in the man that you are today?
Look, it's really interesting. I'm an eternal optimist, you know, and so one of my, whether you call it a gift, whether it's, this is natural or whether this is something that developed as a result of, you know, my childhood. When I was younger, I didn't actually know what I was missing to a degree.
Mm.
Because my parents separated at such a young age, I feel like I actually was blessed with not having to go through that potential trauma of loss that some older kids go through.
Who could understand,
especially
it,
kids, yeah. You know, because I've had friends that have gone through it, both at a, you know, parental level, friends who have parents who have separated and have got teenage kids, and I've, you know, as a teenager, I had friends that were going through the same thing where their parents are separating, and so I saw how traumatic that it was. And so when whenever I see that, I actually feel quite blessed that I didn't actually have to go through, you know, that sense of loss. But at the same time, I did feel like something was missing. You know, I always wanted to have a dad, and I was always asked my mum to go and meet someone and find someone. I was always encouraging her that I wanted to have a dad. Like, even like my mum tells this story and it's quite funny. I always used to go up to randoms in the supermarket when I was about 2 years old, and I'd tug on their trousers, and I'd look down, I'd go, "Daddy?" To my mum's absolute horror, and she would normally run over and go, "Oh, it's all right, I won't tell your wife." But what was really interesting, you know, I had a number of friends as kids, and, you know, I had one friend whose dad was like, you know, he was like the Disneyland dad. He was always high fives, encouragement. He was like a really cool dude. And I used to look at him and go, "Wow, I wish I had a dad like that."
Mm.
But then I had another mate who had a father who, his dad was an alcoholic and an abusive alcoholic, and he actually used to beat him. And I'd go and do sleepovers there, and his dad would drink to the point of obliteration and then come out to wherever we were and then just start slapping this kid around. And that was quite traumatic, and you know, enough to really cause enough trauma in a child to be long lasting. And when I, you know, experienced things like that, I was like, fuck, I'm glad I don't have a dad. And so I kind of grew up with this mixed perspective, but I always was like seeking and searching and hoping that one day that I would have a dad. And I even remember a very early age, and this is where it started, you know, the real benefits start to come in. I didn't know what I was missing, but I always knew what I wanted in a father. And I remember I was about 14 when it was the first time when I consciously started to define, you know, what it is that I wanted in a father. And I realized, well, I'm 14 now. I'm probably not going to really, I don't have the best chance of having like an intimate relationship with a father figure. So I started to go, well, I don't have that opportunity now to have a father, but I'm going to be one. And when I'm going to be one, I'm going to be everything that I wanted in a father. And so at that point, I literally very consciously, very deliberately started to construct the type of father that I was going to be.
Mm.
You know, so I felt like I spent the next 20 years of my life preparing for that role. And so as a result, now being a father, it's actually quite cathartic for me. It's very therapeutic. It's very healing, because now I actually get to be the father that I always wanted, you know, and I get to be the parent at the same time that I always wanted. So it's not just, you know, isolated from a father perspective. It's also, I now get to be the parent, you know, from a support, from an encouragement, most importantly, from a discipline perspective, you know, because I was, you know, pretty heavily disciplined physically as a child. And, you know, that brings with it, you know, its own baggage as well. And so overall, it's not good, it's not bad, it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect, because it's a part of my journey, it's made me who I am. And, you know, I've had people say, if you could go back and change it, would you? And that's like, fuck, that's a really tough question. You know, there's a part of me that goes, no, I wouldn't change it. But there's also another little wounded child inside of me that go, well, it would have been nice. But then it's like, well, I am who I am because of it. Mm. And would I want to change who I am? No, absolutely not. You know, despite, you know, the issues that I've had, you know, dealing with addiction and my own mental health, you know, I wouldn't change who I am, because who I am has allowed me to, you know, affect the people in the way that I do.
Mm, totally. Awesome. Love that. You know, it sounds like you've really used that void to kind of create your values, as you
very, very true. You know, I just, and there's got to be a level of consciousness applied to every situation in order to take something really productive from it. And for me, I don't think I was naturally conscious, but I just was very conscious at that age that I knew what I wanted. I knew it wasn't going to happen for me, but I just thought about how can I use this to be benefit for others, which was going to be, you know, my son when he came through, and who knows, hopefully another child at some point.
Fingers crossed. You know, about 6 months ago, I remember you posted a video of kind of the breakdown of your relationship.
And the social experiment.
Yeah. And that was really, that was a video that really I really resonated with, because firstly, because of your vulnerability and ability to kind of look at yourself like that. But then also, you know, I remember there was a scene there where Noah's trying to get your attention, and you and your partner were at the time were arguing about something.
Yep.
And I really resonated with that, because in that I saw myself, you know, right? As parents, we see that, and we see the mistakes that we make for our children sometimes, right? We're all human and we all make mistakes. I guess what advice or what things do you utilize for yourself when it comes to you making mistakes as a parent, and maybe dealing with that guilt that comes along with it?
Well, I'm, you know, I'd like to say I'm the number one dad in the world, but the reality is, I do the best that I can with the tools that I've got. Mm. My son and myself, my family is very blessed that I've been through an enormous preparation phase in life to get to a point where I think, you know, I think I'm a damn good father. But that being said, and I want to make this really clear, I still fuck it up. Mm. Can we swear on this podcast?
Fucking oath.
All right. I still make mistakes. And those mistakes come in many shapes and forms. The only one mistake that I don't make is I don't strike my child. You know, I was, as I said, I was quite heavily physically disciplined, and that, you know, that still is something that it still comes up, and still issues that I deal with today. And for me, because I remember when I was sitting down, my son was about 2.5 years of age. He was sitting on the couch and he was, you know, he was misbehaving, and I was looking at him, and all of a sudden I just started flashing through like every beating that I got, like every wooden spoon that was broken on me, you know, like every, and my mum's a great mum. Don't get me wrong. And I don't want to paint the wrong picture here, because she's incredible. But I started to flash through every single way that I'd been disciplined, and I literally burst into tears, because I was looking at this kid thinking, how the fuck could I do that to you? There's no way in hell I could do that to you. And then I started to think about my mum, and I was like, fuck, what kind of pain was she in order to, you know, get to that place where she would inflict that on a small child. So, you know, the one mistake I don't make, you know, and touch wood, I would never make that mistake. I don't strike my child. Mm. But, you know, I've had situations where I have screamed at my child, you know, and that's been rare. You know, the most common mistake that I make is I raise my voice. And that is not something that happens on a very regular occasion at all. Occasionally, I let him watch a little bit too much TV. But I'm like I don't know if I am like everybody else, but I'll give you the perfect example. The moment I raise my voice, my son and I are so connected. The moment I start raising my voice, he just looks at me and I can see his heart start to break. Mm. And I'm quite proud of the fact that whenever I raise my voice, literally within a matter of 5 to 10 seconds, sometimes even sooner, I'll be mid-sentence of raising my voice, I'll see his whole physiology start to shift, and then I'll just go, fuck. And then I'll just literally get down on one knee and I'll go, mate, that is, and even if he's the one being a shit, right? I'll get down on one knee and I will allow myself to take that responsibility, regardless of, it's not about what's right or what's wrong or who's right or who's wrong. It's not about who's right. It's about what's right. Mm. And so for me, it doesn't matter what a child does. No child really deserves to be screamed at. Although that's going to be a part of many children's journey, and that's not a negative thing. That's just a thing that child will have to learn how to deal with. Because one of the things that I learned is when you scream at a child, their brain starts, or when a child is misbehaving, or when a child is, you know, having a meltdown, their brain starts to behave in a very different way. You know, there's this old saying called flipping your lid, you know, and it's actually a very literal concept. Is because when a child starts to have a meltdown, their ability to connect with their rational mind is completely gone out the window. The frontal lobe actually ceases to communicate with the rest of the brain, so they can't think rationally. You know, and oftentimes when a child is melting down, that's when someone will yell at the child. And this is a child that is experiencing a high level of stress in a high level of emotion. They're not equipped at that stage of their life to regulate it. And the only person that they look to for safety in their world, because they're feeling incredibly safe, is their parent, right? And when a child melts down, they melt down because they don't feel safe. And if they're not feeling safe, and their only point of safety and certainty in the world is that parental maternal figure, and that figure is yelling at them, then you've got some real issues. And I know this is a bit of a bugbear for some people. It's like, well, you know, fucking what are we, nanny parents? Well, it's not about nanny parents. It's about understanding the neurological development of a child and what starts to happen to a child when they actually feel unsafe. Because when a child feels unsafe and they don't have the facilities to regulate, it's the parent's responsibility to sit down and hold them and show them how to regulate, hold a child and breathe. So the child might be melting down. And as hard as this is, like when my child has a meltdown, you know, 99% of the time, what I do is I'll get down to his level, I'll hold him and I'll just breathe and I just stay calm. And I let him just express the emotion, high emotion, loud emotion. It's big, it's ugly, it's fucking messy. But I don't tell him to stop. I just say, let it out, buddy. Just let it out, buddy. Just let it out, buddy. And sooner or later, guess what he does? He calms the fuck down. But the most important thing is I showed him how to do that, you know, through it's what's called attunement. He's attuned to me. His body's attuned. His body can feel that my body is calm. Okay. His senses can feel that my body is calm. And so as a result, his body picks up on that and takes the lead. Versus if he's melting down and I'm melting down, he's got no point of stability. And so I'm like every other parent. When I raise my voice at my child, the only thing is I catch myself straight away. I'll get down his level and I'll say, buddy, daddy's so sorry. I'm so sorry that I yelled at you. I really hope you can forgive me. I'm really sorry. And sometimes I'll do this with tears streaming down my face because I'm my worst critic, and I beat myself. No one could ever say something worse to me than what I say to myself. And people might say, well, that's a little bit destructive. No, I learned how to manage it. But what I'm saying is I'm pretty tough on myself. And so, you know, when I hurt my child, I take it personally. Now, when I hurt his feelings, and so I'll get down and I'll apologize to him. And 9 out of 10 times, he'll literally just hug me, look me in the eye, all right, go, that's all right, daddy, I forgive you.
Oh, it breaks your heart.
Oh, and that, and then I'll just sit there and go, oh, fuck. But, you know, and then it's like, well, it was worth it just for that, you know? But that in itself is part of his journey. You know, his journey is, you know, for me to inflict, in some cases, small wounds that he's going to have to learn how to deal with that'll build his character. But my goal is to, in situations like that, not create massive wounds that create such a psychological deficit that it affects the neurological development and maladaptive brain, and creates a maladaptive brain which, you know, has all sorts of other ramifications around behavioral disorders, mood disorders, mental health, and especially addiction. Yes, yes. You know, and so yes, I do make mistakes. I do raise my voice at my child. You know, I do some very rarely for me to yell, but like I said, I'm very quick to catch myself and pull myself into line. But the worst thing that I actually do sometimes, because I work a lot and I do sometimes struggle for energy, is I let my child sometimes watch more TV than what I allow. You know, we went through a whole period last year where we banned TV for almost a 12-month period, and it was great. We spent a lot of time together, lots of connection. But it creeps back in because it's a great little babysitter sometimes, especially if you like trying to fucking make a meal and, you know, they're right at you and they're chomping at your heels. And it was just the other day, I was absolutely flogged, right? And we're sitting at home. It was 37 degrees. I don't want to go outside when it's 37 degrees. I want to stay inside where it's nice and cool in the air conditioning. And I was like, and he's like, daddy, can we watch TV? And we hadn't watched TV in 4 or 5 days, but I let him sit down and we watched TV together for about 4 hours. But at the end of it, I'm beating myself up because I'm like, the more screen time children get, the higher probability of, you know, their brain developing in a different way which in most cases the natural consequence is ADHD. I'm ADHD as well. Yeah. ADHD is a precursor to addiction in some cases. And so, you know, I overthink shit, as you can see. But I feel guilty and I beat myself up. And so, yeah, I do make mistakes, but it's what those mistakes mean and it's how I deal with them. You know, so when I did that, at the end of the session, I was like, you know, we did watch a little bit more TV than what we probably should have. You do know that, you know, we're not going to do this all the time. And look, I'm really, and I actually said to him, did you have fun today? And he's like, yeah, I had a really good time. I'm like, do you wish you could have spent more time with me? He's like, but we did. We spent the whole day sitting beside each other. I was like, do you wish we could have spent more time doing other things together? He goes, maybe. And I was like, well, I apologize if we didn't get that opportunity to do that, because I only have him half the time. And my goal is, when I have him, is to fill his cup as much as possible, so that when he goes and spends time with his mum, by the time he gets back, you know, his cup is empty from daddy juice.
Yeah.
And he needs me to fill it back up again, because there's nothing worse than a child going back through after a transition or after a period of time with a parent and their cup hasn't been filled, because there'll be an emotional deficit, and that will then manifest in the form of anxiety, misbehavior, you know, in anger in some cases, and you know, and other forms of what you'd call, you know, non-acceptable behavior.
Awesome. Very comprehensive answer, mate. Love it.
Yeah, sorry. I went a bit deep. Sorry, I didn't mean to go too far.
Go deep. Go deep. Yeah. Let's do it.
But I just don't want to sound like the perfect parent, you know?
Oh, totally.
I do a good job. You know, I have no doubt there are other people that do a better job than me, but I still make mistakes. I still feel guilty. You know, I beat myself up because I take this job really seriously. You know, yeah. I'm producing we're producing the next generation.
That's right, yeah.
And, you know, I look at my business, I look at everything else. He's my greatest legacy. I don't see myself leaving behind money. I'm leaving behind this incredible human being that if I condition, support, train and coach properly, he's going to be able to create and affect 10 times the change that I have in my lifetime.
Huge. So I want us to keep on, mate, because I've got a bunch of questions here.
Nah,
so
far away.
What were your, towards the end of the relationship with it's Chris, I believe.
Kristen.
What, you know, when you got to the point where it was like, okay, I think things are going, we're going to split.
Yep.
I think, you know, towards the end here, okay, I'm coming to terms with maybe this is a possibility. What were your major fears, concerns, worries, apprehensions about that experience?
Yeah, good question. I still remember the first time my ex-wife, Chris, floated by past me. She goes, I think we should separate, which was about 2 years before we actually did separate. I was completely unprepared. And the first time that she suggested, she said, I think we should separate. You know, we had a 2-year-old child at this point, 18-month-old, 2-year-old child. And I immediately went to, my ideal started to crack. And because when I got married at 36. I had this ideal that I'm not going to get married until I find the one. And I'm only marrying one person in this lifetime because I'm a committed individual, yeah. Right? And so when she suggested that, my whole world was starting to rock because I was like, well, hang on, shit, I thought we could get through anything. You know, my vows, to me, the vows that we went through, they were like solemn. Mm. And I literally fell into a heap, walked into the pantry, slumped into a corner, and I'm not kidding, I hysterically cried easily for about half an hour. I just sobbed and sobbed, like hysterically. Even getting emotional now, thinking about it.
Oh, it's all right, mate.
No, it's all good. You know, my wife came in. She couldn't console me. I was just devastated because it just hadn't entered my world. Because to me, I'm a fucking problem solver, bro. There's nothing I can't do. If I want something, I'll fucking do whatever it takes to get there. Mm. And but, you know, not everyone thinks the same way that we do, you know. And what I mean by that is we're all individuals and different. We all have our own values. And I'd compromised her values to such a degree that it was no longer something that she saw that was important enough to keep pursuing at that point. And so, you know, I made the promises, you know, all right, what needs to change? I'll change. I literally was like, I'll fucking do anything, anything, you name it. I'll do it, whatever it is. I'm not giving my son, you know, a family that's not together. At the time, I was using language like broken family. And I was like, do you understand the statistics of broken families and children who end up as addicts? I'm an addict. I'm like, I don't want my child to go through what I've been through, although it's been the greatest development I've had. But I started spitting out all that. I was like, we have to, for the sake of Noah, not ourselves, but for the sake of Noah, we have to find a way to work this out. And then over the next 2 years, you know, it was used intermittently here and then. So I became a little bit more desensitized to it. Mm. So by the time we got to crunch time, 3 months prior to that, we had sat down and gone, okay, we think it's time to separate. And I was like, look, we've been through counts, we've been through everything. Mm. Look, and I was like, I just feel in my gut, let's just give it 3 more months. And she goes, yeah, okay. So we set a date, 3 more months, and we worked towards, and the next, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks were amazing. They were magical. They were like when we got together. And then a few things started to go downhill and it started to crumble again. And I remember I literally had just finished an Allen Scarlett. So, you know, bear in mind, I'd just done like 3 weeks of traveling around Australia. Then I just backed it up with an Allen Scarlett. I came home. I was absolutely shattered. And then she said, yeah, I think it's time for us to separate. I've already moved my stuff into a separate room. And I literally said, yeah, you're right. I said, just so you know, I'm not ready to quit. I'd keep going if you want to, but we have tried everything, you know? So it was at that point, she made the call, but I supported her because, you know, I could see it wasn't working. And the root of your question, what was the feeling?
Yeah, your fears, concerns.
The main fears and concerns really came up in the first round, that 2 years, which was what's going to happen to Noah. Mm. And then they were still present, but my biggest concerns were making sure that it was going to be amicable because my parents, when they split, wasn't amicable. Mm. You know, it was a little bit of tension, a lot of tension, anger, you know, pain back and forth. And yeah, I wanted to make sure that he had the best chance of you know, us working together, even though we were separate in a co-related, co-parenting way, to create a relationship blueprint that, although we weren't together, was still going to be healthy.
Yeah, great. You know, you obviously seem like you have a great relationship or working relationship now.
Yep.
You know, I saw you're in Canada over Christmas. You know, you've done posts about you guys still doing things together with Noah, which is great. So what do you think contributed to you being able to have that kind of a relationship with her?
I had a goal. And my goal was to provide a solid, strong emotional relationship blueprint for Noah. Mm. And I can tell you, there were, in the early stages, there was a lot of stuff going down where I was just like, you know, I could have just fucking, it could have gone bad. Mm. It really could have. But, you know, there comes a time in life where you got to ask yourself this question: do I want to be right? Do I want to be heard? Or do I want to be happy? Mm. You know, I think sometimes in life when there's conflict, people want to be right.
Definitely.
Well, you don't understand. This is the reality. This is my reality. Mm. Or in some cases, people want to be heard. Well, I understand your perspective, but do you understand mine? Mm. And that those both of those things, in essence, can become emotional triggers for the other. Whereas what I learned to do is just suck it up and have situations like where I wanted to respond. I was like, what's more important right here? Do you want to be happy? Mm. Do you want Noah to be happy? Or do you want to be heard and do you want to be right? And I was just like, you know what? My ego doesn't need to be heard. It doesn't need to be right. My focus is on Noah. Mm. I'm going to eat shit on this one. And I had a lot of, and I'm sure Chris would say the same thing. We've all got our own perspective. Mm. But, you know, I had a lot of shit sandwiches. And I don't say that as a disrespect to Chris, because we're both navigating a very painful space. Mm. We're both navigating a very painful transition. So, you know, when people are in pain, they inflict pain, and we're both in a bit of pain. And we're probably both unconsciously and, you know, not deliberately, but unconsciously inflicting a little bit of pain on each other. But what I discovered was, you know, there's got to be one person willing to take, and this isn't a, and I hope this isn't, you know, this isn't a slight at my, I love Chris, even to this day, I still love Chris. But, you know, I was interviewing this girl once, Christine Hasler, and she once said, in a relationship when things are going right, wrong, someone's got to, it's not take the higher road. There's got to be, whoever has the highest consciousness has the greatest responsibility. And Chris is a very conscious girl. But what I realized at that point is I have an enormous responsibility to make sure that this transition is healthy. Mm. Because if I don't, you know, with my personality style, I'm quite intense. Mm. You know, I'm aggressive, but I'm not abusive. But when I feel like I'm right, like I can pursue things quite heavily. And so for me, it was just a matter of stepping back, allowing Chris to have her voice and really just find her space. Because, you know, although it was a challenging time for both of us, you know, I've got to take into account her experience as well. And her experience is she's now a single mum. You know, she didn't have a job. She didn't have a business. You know, she was relying on me for all of her support. And that's a vulnerable position for any human being to be in. And so it required also a lot of compassion to really put myself in her shoes and go, fuck, what would this be like if I was her? And really taking her perspective, not just mine. I know what my perspective is, but I think that's one of the things that is missing in relationships is people be able to, you know, sit in the other chair, put their feet in the other shoes and go, okay, let me just try and understand their experience just so I can, and that to me creates empathy.
Huge.
And empathy is an incredibly therapeutic, cathartic and healing, you know, state to experience.
Yeah. It sounds like there you kind of, I guess maybe, you know, taking fuel away from the fire. In some sense.
Absolutely. You know, starving the fire.
Yeah.
And just understanding what people's values are and making sure that you can meet them to ensure that they feel safe.
Yeah.
And this is actually a really important point. You know, one of the things that I discovered is during that separation, the challenges really only ever arised when Chris felt unsafe. And so what I discovered was the most important things for me was to do whatever I could to make sure she felt safe. You know, and, you know, I think that's a challenge in any relationship, especially in a divorce. You know, when you start going through the financial aspects of divorce, you know, a lot of men will use their position as of power financially to control. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't, and because whenever there was mention of anything of the financial nature, I could see the high level of, you know, fear and uncertainty and unsafety. And when she felt unsafe is when things started to go wrong.
Yeah.
And so I started to realize the importance. And Chris is like any other human. We're all the same, especially children. And one of our number one primal desires or needs is to feel safe. Mm. Because when we're safe, we can think clearly. You know, we can experience happiness. When we're unsafe, you know, our fight or flight is activated. We can't think properly. We're constantly stressed. Everything is bigger than what it seems.
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder to deal with life.
Totally. And so I wanted to find out, you know, through your experience, I guess, what hindsight lessons or advice would you give to other single dads, newly single dads, or other dads who are maybe on the edge or on the brink or in the realm of possibly breaking up?
Yep. Don't make it about you. Don't make it about you. It's not about you. Okay. Mm. Don't take it personally. You know, not everyone is designed to be together forever. Make it about, have a goal, you know, and make the goal about, and again, maybe this, for right or for wrong, my goal was not about me. It wasn't about me. I made it about Noah. Mm. And I was like, right, this journey from here on in, it's less about me and more about him and making sure that I develop a happy, healthy child. The challenge for most people in that scenario is sometimes they don't put their child, there isn't enough value on the child. The value is on the perspective of the individual. And so what dominates is, well, it's not that I don't care about my child, but I'm not going to be treated this way. Mm. That kind of shit versus, look, everyone, and again, I'll say this again, people in pain inflict pain.
Yep.
People aren't naturally assholes. People aren't naturally mean. They just do that when they feel unsafe. They do that when they are in some form of pain. And so, you know, I think another piece of advice that I'll give you, it's not about you, but understand that everyone's got their own perspective, you know, and just because you've got one doesn't mean that it's right. And I'll go back to what I said before. You can either be heard, you can be right, or you can be happy. Ask yourself the question, what's more important? And if you're being heard or you being right is more important, then that's your ego. Mm. Okay. And you and people who want to be right and want to be heard, they're going to experience more pain than most people on this planet. Okay. Because they're attached to that. When you're not attached to that, when you start to remove the buttons from the board, mm. no one can press them. And when no one can press them, no one can piss you off. Oh, and so when you get pissed off at whatever your partner's doing, she's not pissing you off. He's not pissing you off. You're choosing to be pissed off because you don't accept their perspective on some level. Mm. Accept their perspective, surrender, allow yourself to see where they're coming from, but at the same time, give yourself permission to have your own. But in some situations, it doesn't mean that you have to share it, okay? Mm. Share it with your mate. Share it with your therapist, okay? If you have an open, honest, flowing, you will get to that point if you work deliberately and consciously where you'll be able to sit down and eventually you'll be able to share it. But as long as you share it from a place of love and compassion, like my wife and I, we went away at Christmas. We had a little incident at Christmas that brought up and fled up some tension. And normally we address stuff in the moment, but it was Christmas time. It was high stress, lots going on. But it took about a week and a half for us to loop back around and share each other's perspective. Now, Chris had her perspective. I had mine. We still weren't in agreement, but we allowed each other to be heard. Mm. And we accepted each other's perspective and we gave permission for each other to feel the way that we feel. And so there was no yelling, there was no screaming, there was no attack, there was no defense. It was just two conscious human beings sitting down and going, well, fuck, this is what happened for me. What happened for you? Well, this is what happened for me. Fuck, now I understand why you behaved that way. Fuck, now I understand why you behaved that way. Gosh, I'm really sorry for my part in this. I'm really sorry for my part in this too. Sweetheart, I love you. I'm really glad that we can get through this, you know? And that was the gist of the conversation. It was a half hour conversation, but it was very loving. You know, there's no requirement for screaming and yelling, you know, because that's just not how people hear. People don't hear when they're being screamed at.
In that situation, you know, it sounds like Chris is very, you know, conscious and she's very, you know, able to at least have a conversation about how she's feeling and voice those concerns and stuff. But it kind of takes two to tango.
It absolutely does.
In some cases, right?
So if not always.
Definitely not always.
Because sometimes, you know, I'll express lower levels of consciousness. Sometimes she'll express lower levels of consciousness. But in any moment, in order for peace to be maintained, somebody has to maintain the high level. The person with the highest level of consciousness in that moment, and that'll be transient. One day it'll be you. One day it'll be me. One day it'll be Chris. One day it'll be me. Has the responsibility in that moment to go, oh, hang on a second. Let's not make this something that it's not.
Mm. Okay, so what you're saying there is that even maybe if the other person isn't, it doesn't give you an excuse not to be the conscious person in that moment and work through that.
Yeah. Find where your buttons are and take them off the table.
Mm, self-awareness.
Yeah, man, huge. That's key.
Awesome, brother. Well, thanks for jumping on here today.
Was there another question? You can keep going because I know you had another question in this. Did you have one more?
I do. I'm just conscious of the time and
mate,
stuff, mate.
Come but, on, let's do it.
So look, what are your biggest lessons, learnings of the breakup about yourself or about life?
Oh, and I'm glad you asked this question because this is really important to me. You know, in the early stages, as I said, it was a little bit uncertain, a little bit rocky, but the real beauty came in when we finally did separate. Because initially we started to nest, and nest is where you have the matrimonial home and one parent stays with the child for 1 week and the other parent stays in an apartment nearby. Mm. And then the next week the parents swap, the other parent's in the apartment.
Right.
So the child has a basis of now I'm spending independent time with each parent, but I'm still in the same place.
Yep.
So it creates less stress, less anxiety, and less, you know, potential trauma for the child. And we did that for, you know, a few months. And after a few months, we separated properly. And my relationship with my son over that time just blossomed. Now, because my wife, she's an incredible mother, ex-wife, is an incredible mother. But she's got a very dominant parenting style, not towards Noah, but in terms of, no, I'll take care of it. You know, I've got it. And what happened was, is I'm a very disciplined, structured, boundary-driven individual, you know, and that's something that's very healthy, not just for humans, but especially for people who've got a history with addiction. And so when I was trying to put certain boundaries in, there was a little bit of flexibility on her side, so my son would always default to her. Mm. And as a result, sometimes he was given the opportunity to make decisions that he wasn't capable of making. And when you give children the opportunity to make decisions that they're not capable of making, they experience anxiety and stress. Mm. They may demonstrate on the outside that they want to decide, but internally they're going bananas. It's like a dog. When you treat a dog like a human, they're like, they literally freak out. They'll start to dig holes in the backyard. They'll start to chew up things because they're like, I need someone to fucking lead me. Okay, I can't be your, dogs are like, I can't be your peer. I'm not your peer. And if you don't try to lead me, I'm going to try and lead you. And I don't know how to lead a human, so I'm fucking going to lose my shit and try and work it out, right? And kids are very much the same. They need to be led. Mm. They need to be, and I'm not saying control. They need to have structure. They need to have discipline. They need to know where the boundary is because they don't know where it is themselves. And so when Chris and I eventually separated and I was, you know, co-parenting as a single father, I was able to parent the way that I wanted to the whole time. And finally, I was empowered to parent the way that I wanted to. And Noah just bloomed. He just bloomed and he went from, and you know, and I don't say this with a disrespect in any way, he went from being a mummy's boy to a daddy's boy because he really started to feel the benefits of structure. He really started to feel the benefits of boundaries. And as a result, you know, he started to crave that and he started to miss me and he started to want to be around me more because, you know, he felt better in that environment. And, you know, and Chris has adopted, you know, some of that now and a lot of that now as well. And the relationship between us just transformed. Absolutely. And I'm like, and all of a sudden, like, it's like, wow, it's amazing what has to happen in order for us to live and express our potential. Because, you know, I had to, you know, my whole goal was 14 years onwards, I want to be the best dad in the world. I'm going to be the designer dad, right? And then I marry and I have a child. I'm like, yeah, finally I'm there. And then we separate. I'm like, oh no. But now I'm now able to parent and be the father that I've always wanted to be, which I wasn't for whatever reason able to in that relationship. And that's no slight on Kristen because she's an incredible mother, but you know she's quite, you know she's very very powerful in that context. And you know I allowed myself to step back and just and allow that to be taken care of because I didn't want to rock the boat. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And now it's I'm not rocking anyone's boat. I'm just rocking mine, and we rock it out.
It happened how it was meant to, mate.
It's perfect. And I'm eternally grateful for Chris. I'm eternally grateful to her family, like her family, Noah's family. They're my family. And, you know, I don't come from a big family and she does. And I feel incredibly blessed that I married. I couldn't have married and had a child with a better person at this stage. And whatever's coming next, I'm very, very excited about. But I'm glad it was with. I'm glad it was her. I'm glad it was with her and with her family because, yeah, it's an incredible cathartic opportunity also for Noah because now he has the big family that I always wanted, so to speak, and so do I in some respects. And I can see the healing, the intergenerational healing that's taking place as a result of that, if that makes sense.
Oh, beautiful, yeah.
Because oftentimes our kids will adopt ancestral issues.
100%, yeah.
And, you know, that's where also as a parent, one of the lessons that I've learned is do the work so your kids don't have to. Mm. And I don't mean to make them lazy. I mean, if the more you work on your personal issues, the less chance you have of transferring it onto them.
Yeah.
You know, and them having to deal with it. And it's not about making their life easier, but it's about removing some of the obstacles that perhaps make life harder than it needs to be.
Yeah, like pass on your wisdom, not your wounds.
Yeah, as they say. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So talking about Noah, you know, you say a lot that Noah has been kind of one of the biggest learning experiences that you've ever had. So maybe just share with us what effect has it had on your identity?
It's made me a better human being, made me more compassionate. It's made me a far better leader. It's made me a better speaker. It gives me the lessons that are required for me to continually evolve, not just as a human being, you know, which are sometimes painful, but also as a business person. Because, you know, being the parent to the child is the greatest leadership role you will ever have in life. And you start to learn lessons about how to lead based on what the child does. And those lessons are directly transferable into the business environment, you know, because you start to learn you can't scream at a fucking employee. You can't smack an employee. Mm. Okay, you can't send an employee to the corner. Imagine if you did that shit. Imagine, right? Now, and what's interesting, they're only now starting to outlaw some of that shit for kids. Mm. But that's how people have been treating kids for a long time. Mm. And I think it's important to realize that, you know, how you parent a child is how you lead an organization. Mm. You know, you create an environment of safety. Okay, you allow people to stretch their legs, but you also help show them where the boundaries are if they're not sure themselves. You know, you pass on the wisdom of the things that you've learned through vulnerability, mm. which you do with your children, you know, and you allow them at the same time to take their lessons along the way, and you give them a bit of a nudge when it's required. And every now and then you do have to sit down and have a tough conversation with them, but you do it from a place of love. You don't do it from a place of trying to dominate them, you know, mm. trying to control them and be their boss. You do it from a place of, dude, I just want... Because with your child, the more you try to dominate your child, the more it's going to rebel. You know, and this is the thing, and this is one other thing I'll leave the listeners with. You know, kids only rebel when they get to a physical stature that they can. And they only rebel when they get to a physical stature that allows them to do that when they've been controlled. Mm. Okay, because most parents, they discipline through domination and control. No, you can't do that. Don't do that. I'll send you to the room. And the kids are like trying, well, what the fuck? How am I? They're not learning anything. You're not sitting down and teaching them good decision-making practices when you send them to the room or you put them in the naughty corner. And when my son misbehaves, I'll sit down and say, okay, so do you know why we're having this conversation? Okay, so what did we do? What could we have done better? Okay, mm-hmm. And what can we do next time? Okay, and so he actually learned something from that process. And I think it's really important to understand the more we are able to treat our kids not just as not as adults, but as humans, the more they actually develop into healthy adults in the same place. And they get to that point where, you know, because if you dominate a child, by the time they're 14, they don't trust you. Mm. Okay, you don't know anything, dad. You don't know anything, mum. Mm. Okay, because there's been no understanding between you. Mm. By that point, and so as a result, what do? They sneak out, they rebel, they fucking start taking and experimenting with drugs and boys and girls. Whereas if you can allow a child and give the child the space and you can work with the child and show them how to make better decisions, by the time they get to 14, they don't have to rebel. Mm. There's nothing to rebel against.
Yeah.
People only rebel against resistance. Don't create resistance, create conversations, create understanding. You know, I've had people say, oh, my two-year-old doesn't understand anything. I can't sit down and talk to my two-year-old. And I was like, well, fuck, I can. Mm. You know, when my son was two, we had really good five, we have full-blown conversations now. You know, he knows what a fucking molecule is. He knows what an atmosphere is. And if he knows what a molecule and atmosphere, I can tell you right now, he understands the emotional context. Oh, he can sit there and say, Daddy, that was rude. I don't appreciate it when you speak to me like that. You know, he can say, Daddy, you know, and sometimes it's for no reason whatsoever because he's just like, you know, not getting what he's wanting. Can I have this? No, that was rude, Dad. It's like, well, no, it wasn't. You know, I was just actually saying no. So, I hope that helps.
No, that's amazing, amazing insight. So awesome to have you on here, mate. It's a real pleasure. Thank you for taking the time out to speak to us. And, the things that you've been speaking about today have been, you know, just invaluable.
Really. Thanks, mate.
So, I'm sure everyone listening will really enjoy it.
Thanks, Miller. Appreciate being here.
No worries, mate. We'll check out Kerwin Ray. Where can we find you?
KerwinRay.com, Facebook, Instagram. Snapchat, LinkedIn. Yeah, I'm all over the shop.
Yeah, yeah. You're not that YouTube. Hard to find.
Just Google me.
That's very honest.
Thanks, Miller. Appreciate it. All right,
mate. No worries.
Thanks, buddy.